This episode of Between the Rows was brought to you in part by Bayer. Bayer continues to make significant investments into the development of new breeding technologies and state-of-the-art cropping solutions to ensure the profitability and sustainability of your farm. This season, grow with confidence. Grow with Bayer. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Laura Rance, Glacier Farm Media's editorial director, reveals leading-edge weed control practices demonstrated at Ag in Motion.
We've gone in a lot of situations to narrow windrow burning, so we'll put a chute on the back of the combine and try and concentrate the chaff down to a half-metre strip. It is unbelievably effective. It's quite a cheap technique and it might cost you $400 or $500.
Alexis Stockford of Manitoba Cooperator tells us what she learned at the International 4-H Summit last month in Ottawa. And Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media Director of Weather and Markets, gives us a heads up on what the numbers are doing.
The forefront right now is a concern about the corn and soybean crops. And, of course, that influences not only our wheat prices and canola prices, but also the general market itself because of the size of these two commodities.
All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Gord Gilmore.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Most farmers have had at least some experience with herbicide resistance on their farms. It starts with a few plants and then a few patches of a weed that doesn't die when sprayed with a herbicide that's always worked before. Before long, those weeds are taking down your yields. Well, as the saying goes, the best defense is a good offense. Our editorial director, Laura Rance, has a report on how to prevent this problem on your farm.
While farmers were taking in the sights at the recent Ag in Motion Farm Show near Saskatoon, I caught up with some special guests brought in for the show from the United Kingdom and Australia to talk about how farmers can keep one step ahead of herbicide resistance on their farms. Gowan Canada, which of course sells herbicides, brought in Robert Place, who works for the same company in the UK, and Craig Hall, who is with a division of CPS in Australia, to talk about herbicide resistance strategy with prairie farmers based on the experience of farmers in their countries. I asked Craig Hall from Australia what the situation is like for farmers in his country.
In a word, shocking. We have a lot of resistance to glyphosate, obviously being the world's biggest herbicide and very important from a cropping perspective. So we're very fortunate to still have paraquat on the market over in Australia. I don't know how much longer that's going to last, quite a while I hope. So we employ a double knock technique, so we'll do a full rate of glyphosate and follow that up 3 to 14 days later with a full rate of either gramoxone or spray seed. And the idea is not to control a second germination of weeds, it's to try and control anything that was missed by the glyphosate that hasn't controlled. And that works extremely well.
Craig also talked about mixing up pre-emergent herbicides with post-emergent herbicides.
Again, with the pre-emergent, we're trying to steer away from one mode of action only. So we've got a lot of trifluralin resistance in Australia, and I'm talking generally about ryegrass, which is our biggest problem. So we mix up our groups. So one of our most popular brews is trifluralin plus Avidex. We've got trifluralin working on the roots of the plant. You've got Avidex working on the emerging coleoptile. So two completely different modes of action. And that has extended the use of both of those herbicides quite significantly. And we're getting very, very good activity from a pre-emergent perspective. The pre-emergence, again, if we can have at least two modes of action, quite often we're using three, sometimes we're even using four, and it's all about trying to reduce the amount of weeds that get through and trying to reduce that seed set. Vitally important. We're trying to take away group one chemistry, say, in cereal crops, because the selection pressure there is extremely high, and use them only in our broadleaf crops. And vice versa, we're using our broadleaf herbicides only in our cereal crops. And it's all about trying to reduce that selection pressure.
Craig Hall says the key to success is to do whatever you can to keep these weeds from escaping some kind of control and going to seed. But both of these speakers told farmers they need to find methods beyond herbicides to control the weeds if they are serious about avoiding herbicide resistance.
We've gone in a lot of situations to narrow windrow burning, so we'll put a chute on the back of the combine and try and concentrate the chaff down to a half-metre strip. And if we can get the burning temperature up to 400 degrees for 10 minutes, we'll control our grass weeds. If we can get it up to 600 degrees for 10 minutes, we're controlling our broadleaf weed seeds. It is unbelievably effective. It's quite a cheap technique, and it might cost you $400 or $500 to put a chute on the back of a combine. And as long as you get that row burnt, and that's the thing that I've been talking to a few Canadian farmers about, that might be a bit interesting in the conditions you have here. And look, we've got to pick our days as well, because we're trying not to burn the entire stubble. We're just trying to burn that particular row. So we don't want it too windy. We don't want it too hot. If we can get that row to burn at a nice hot temperature, which is why we concentrate the chaff, then it's extremely effective. The other thing that we've just introduced into Australia, or has been developed in Australia, is the integrated Harrington weed seed destructor. And I believe Ray has been over here to talk to farmers. I think that is a real game changer. It works on impact. So it's two rotating bowls that's integrated straight into the back of the combine. It's driven hydraulically. The seed is smashed up to become non-viable. So we're getting very high 90% control of our weed seeds. They get spat out of the back of the combine and they're non-viable. But to me, that is brilliant. It's going to really revolutionise our non-chemical control of ryegrass.
Robert Place, who works for Gowan in the UK, went even further. He told farmers that the age of herbicide-dominated weed control is over and that herbicide resistance will radically change our approach to arable farming.
I think the key mistake that we've made is innovation has been so good in the past. You know, we've always had the next innovation coming. We've had the regulatory regime to allow that. We've had the innovation from the companies to do that. The situation has changed, and now when we look forward, we haven't got that new technology coming in a bottle. So we have to protect the technology we have, and we have to learn how to use it better and get the best from it. So I think that's really the big thing that's changed.
Robert Place offered up a pretty long list of alternatives to herbicides, ranging from changing up your seeding dates, choosing more competitive varieties, and more diverse crop rotations. Farmers in his country are dealing with a weed called black grass. It's forcing them to do all that, as well as to use more tillage, and in some cases, leaving their land fallow. Robert said there are some strategies that would be particularly effective for prairie farmers dealing with our most common weeds.
If we said, for example, that wild oats were potentially Western Canada's big issue, there are two things within the talk that we did that you can practice, and one is make sure you take as many out pre-drilling as you can. Don't leave anything there to be in situ when you drill the crop. And secondly, start to diversify the chemistry groups you're using pre-emergence. The pre-emergence chemistry, it can be diverse. We have those options. It can be robust with the rates we use, but also it actually targets the weed at a time when it's at its most vulnerable. So I think those two things you could do in Canada would definitely slow down, or potentially not prevent, but maybe a little bit, but we'd definitely stop you getting in the situation, I think, that we've got ourselves.
The point these speakers were in Canada to make is that there's still time to avoid this. It's worth the time and effort and the money it takes to avoid having this problem on your farm. But that's a hard sell. There weren't very many farmers attending the session I took in. I asked Craig Hall, who is also a farmer, why farmers are so resistant to prevention.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think, first and foremost, it's a hit to the hip pocket. I really do. And, you know, we're back to the situation with some crops where we get escapes where you just say, well, we know we're not going to control that. We're just going to cut it for hay. And, you know, that then becomes far less profitable than taking it through. And I think profit's obviously the big driver. And the issue with some cropping rotations is they become very profit-resistant. But I think in the short term, to take that hit, knowing that you can be sustainable in the long term, is such a big thing. And you know, we've witnessed it in Australia now. unless you start employing techniques now to make sure that you are sustainable into the future, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more.
For Between the Rows, I'm Laura Rantz.
Showing us that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, that was Laura Rantz, editorial director of Glacier Farm Media. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore. We're joined now by Alexis Stockford. She's a reporter for the Manitoba Cooperator who recently attended the second Global 4-H Summit in Ottawa, July 11th to 14th. It was the first time that the summit's been held in Canada since the Global 4-H Network was formed in 2014. There were 484 acres from 35 countries. Alexis, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Gord. Great to be here.
So was it worth the trip?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Other than the fact of just being in Ottawa, which was amazing in and of itself, I was actually really impressed by the scope of it. Just because, like, when I was growing up in Manitoba, obviously in rural Manitoba, I was part of 4-H, and 4-H was very omnipresent, but it was more of at a community level, you know? So you were worried about your speeches or your projects, and you didn't really think about 4-H outside of North America. So arriving at this place, and that there's representatives from 35 countries there, it was pretty impressive. And I really enjoyed talking to a lot of the delegates about just the differences in their 4-H programs, you know, what they do differently than we do. And there was this really, really interesting tie between their 4-H programs and their priorities of their 4-H programs and the larger issues that that country might be facing.
So what was that like? Like, can you give us an example of that?
Sure. So I guess one example might be the 4-H program in Kenya, and where food security is a concern, and they're in the middle of a drought right now and have been for years. And in their 4-H program, I met a Kenyan delegate who was telling me about these multi-story vertical gardens that some of these 4-H programs are doing in low-income urban areas, which are kind of combining water conservation and food security. And then you've got other countries like Gambia and Ghana, and both of them make specific mention in their 4-H programs about HIV and AIDS.
So a lot of differences between the countries then. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those then?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was a Gambian delegate that I met that kind of put it best. He basically said that 4-H in Africa is all about access, so making what they are already offering available to as many youth as possible. In contrast, in North America, it's become all about choice. So expanding the range of projects that we're offering, more projects, and that, of course, is trying to expand 4-H's appeal in North America and try and get some of the urban areas involved in this as a way to kind of bolster 4-H numbers as numbers have declined over the decades.
Mm. So you've spoken about the differences between the countries, but I'm sure there were similarities. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there absolutely were. And, of course, like you would expect with 4-H, agriculture was a huge one. And then also, like 4-H Canada participants might be familiar with, youth empowerment and leadership was a huge deal and something that was reflected in all 4-H programs just across the board, no matter what continent your 4-H program was in. A little bit newer was this focus on science and technology. And that was enough of a focus that it actually had a full day of the summit that was devoted to it.
So I know it's going to be tough for you to kind of boil it down like this, but I'm sure that you brought some main takeaways home with you. What were the things that you, as you were flying home on the plane, you were thinking about?
Oh, you know, honestly, there was so much. We would be sitting here all day if I went through it all. I think one of the main things that I noticed was that there was the point of the conference was kind of twofold. So yeah, you had the youth, and the youth were learning, and it will hopefully bring those connections and that knowledge back to their home countries. But there were also a whole bunch of organizers and 4-H leaders there, and they were also learning and getting ideas that they can bring back. So you had 4-H leaders who were learning how to introduce their kids to GIS technology or how to set up an international art exchange and things like that. There was just this huge diversity in topics.
Did you happen to cross paths with any of the delegates from the Prairie region?
Yeah, I did. And interestingly, there were quite a few, not only delegates from Manitoba, but some presenters as well. And one of them, Clayton Robbins, he actually started up this sort of impromptu international experiment on soil activity by handing out these cotton swatches that he asked his workshop attendees to bury once they got home. And they've all agreed that after 2 months they're going to dig them up and measure the decomposition of these cotton swatches, which is a way to measure soil activity, and they're going to share those results online.
Now, the idea of this global 4-H network, it's young. It was signed in 2014 in South Korea, I think you mentioned earlier. In that time, has it made much of a difference for the programs in 4-H, both internationally and on the national level?
I think it has, or at least it has from the perspective of the delegates that I spoke to. And certainly it's fostered communication. I know just walking through the lunchroom, you saw people kind of grouped together, and you were hearing some plans for international cooperation and cross-border cooperation and some brainstorming sessions between delegates from different countries. And then, of course, just the structure of the organization itself with the regional roundtables, with the board meetings, it allows 4-H from different regions to bring forward any issues or priorities that they would want addressed. Now, like you mentioned, organizationally, it's still very young. So where the board takes it from here, I guess we're just going to have to wait to find out.
Great. Alexis, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Once again, that was the Manitoba Cooperators reporter, Alexis Stockford, on the Global 4-H Summit held in Ottawa this July. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore. It's all eyes on the sky right now as the crop continues to progress. Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Markets and Weather, is here to talk to us about what's been going on in markets, what effect the weather's having, and maybe a little information about that pesky Canadian dollar that keeps going up. Bruce, how are you today?
Not too bad.
Great. Glad you could be here. Tell us a little bit about what's been going on in Western Canada in terms of weather and what that's meant for our markets.
Well, certainly we've seen a continuation of warmer than normal temperatures through July here and into early August, possibly, if the forecast comes true. So we've seen the crop develop rapidly, but there are a lot of areas of stress, especially in the southern growing areas of the prairies. Also into the central and northern areas, we've seen some pockets that have run out of moisture and the crops are being stressed now. So overall, the condition of the Canadian crop continues to decline, and given the forecast that we have right now, it looks as if we're not going to get a lot of rain here in the first half of August.
Mm-hmm. And then really after the first half of August is done, you're getting into the area where you don't want a rain. So it's a narrow window that the weather has to hit if it's going to do any good, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Rain past August 15th through the 20th is not going to be really useful for the crop. Certainly, we need it sooner rather than later.
What about turning to the States now? We've seen a lot of concern over the weather down there. Can you give us a bit of a rundown of what's been happening and what effect that's having on their crop and on markets?
Well, everyone's familiar with the situation in the spring wheat growing areas in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and that region has been under severe stress almost from the start of the planting season here. So really, that's been a concern of the U.S. markets, but that information has been more or less digested by the futures traders, and we are expecting a smaller U.S. spring wheat crop. So that's not really at the forefront right now. At the forefront right now is a concern about the corn and soybean crops. And of course, that influences not only our wheat prices and canola prices, but also the general market itself because of the size of these two commodities. What has happened is the western areas of the Corn Belt, and I would include Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, especially in that group of states, have been dry through the month of July, and that's causing some stress to the corn and soybean crops. And we've seen the overall conditions drop a bit, not an awful lot, and certainly in the central and eastern areas of the Corn Belt, the crops are good. But we are at this point now where the market is paying very close attention to the forecast. So if a forecast changes, and we all know that weather forecasts change almost every 6 hours or so, we're seeing a different viewpoint from the market at that point in time. So really, we're seeing a lot of volatility here. One day it seems the market feels as if we're going to be hot and dry and the corn and soybean yields are going to drop, and the next day, oh, there's lots of rain and we don't have to worry about it. So this is just a very volatile trading session.
And in that volatility, in your opinion, are there pricing opportunities for farmers? Is this something that farmers should be looking at now?
Certainly there are some pricing opportunities. In general, what has happened is the markets have rallied, hit highs, and then dropped back as we go, went into about the middle or end of July. So we're in a trading range right now. Certainly, I think it probably behooves one to wait it out a little bit here in terms of the volatility, especially on the oil seeds, because we have the month of August still left here to create some problems for the soybean crop. At the same time, our canola crop's also in a bit of trouble here, with especially in the central and southern areas that haven't received a lot of rain. So those two factors should help support prices in the longer term, and it might be one of those times to just step back and reflect a little bit before we get into the harvest season.
One of the things that Canadian farmers have benefited from for the last little while has been a weak loonie. It's protected them from the falling prices denominated in U.S. dollars. We've seen the loonie on a bit of a tear. I think in the last month it's appreciated, what, about 10%, something like that? What effect is that going to have then?
Well, certainly it's having an impact on the cash prices that farmers see for virtually all the commodities we produce in Western Canada. So that is an issue. We've seen this bump up for, I think, primarily two reasons. One reason was the market was very short the Canadian dollar 2 months ago, and turns out that the Canadian economy was better, and the Bank of Canada decided to boost its interest rates. And the combination of those two factors have really pushed the dollar higher. I think we're at a point now, though, where all of that trade from the shorts is gone, and we're now looking just at what are the fundamentals for the Canadian dollar. So for the Canadian dollar to push any higher from this point, we'd have to see a lot more good economic news. And I really don't think that that's on the horizon here. I think it's probably going to be more steady as she goes. In that kind of a scenario, I would expect the Canadian dollar to drop back here as we move into the fall and winter months, which is good news, I think, for farmers. That will help support our commodity prices here in Western Canada, at least anyway, because of the fact that the dollar is dropping. One other big factor has been the weakness of the U.S. dollar. With the Trump administration and all the machinations that have gone on there, the dollar, U.S. dollar has gone on the index value from about 105 at its peak all the way down to about 93 right now. So those that move in itself means that we're certainly benefiting from a weaker U.S. dollar. That's strengthening the Canadian dollar by itself without any big change to the fundamentals for Canada.
So is that a situation you feel that we should be sort of keeping our eye on then headed into the winter and really watching closely?
I would say so. Certainly, I think the Canadian dollar right now is overvalued above this 80-cent mark. So I would look for it to drift lower here, and that might create some pricing opportunities here, especially if we see some commodities get tighter as we move through the marketing year.
That's great, Bruce. Thanks a lot for that.
You're welcome.
That was Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Markets and Weather. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Thanks for joining us this week for Between the Rows. If you enjoyed this program, please follow us on Twitter at GFM Podcasts. You'll be alerted with all the latest news and information from Between the Rows, and please retweet us so that your friends can join us each week. Thanks for listening this week. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Between the Rows. Our goal at Bayer is to continue to progress our lineup of high-performing seed and crop protection solutions so that we can meet specific grower needs like yours. Because when it comes to your farm, Bayer is with you from beginning to end. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.